Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Hello and welcome to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and each and every week I am devoted to the vision of a free and virtuous society. And to do that, we want to defend capital markets, defend free enterprise, and dig into those conversations in which the contemporary debate about free enterprise lives. And one of those venues right now, alive and well in people sort of adjudicating what to make of capital markets, is the world of banking. And of course, we devoted a lot of podcast time to the fall of Silicon Valley Bank, which, depending on what seat you're sitting in, when I say it was now 6-7 weeks ago, that either seems like it was much longer than that or it seems like it was shorter. I suppose it's all about perspective, but quite a bit's happened in the world since then, and really even just the immediate week, 2 weeks after that were quite news filled. But there's a lot of focus in the world of banks, small banks, community banks, regional banks, and you know what the impact is into big banks. As I sit here recording right now, we're a little over a week into earnings season. Earnings season always on Wall Street starts with some of the big banks kicking things off, usually on the same day. JP Morgan Chase, Citi, Bank of America, Wells Fargo all release. All of them more or less released a little better results than expected. And since then, some of the publicly held regionals, Truist and now First Republic, came out and deposit withdrawals were even worse than expected, and they had been expected to be pretty bad. So this whole thing kind of lingers in public markets. But that's not so much our big focus here today. I am very excited to welcome, as a first-time guest on Capitol Record, and we are sitting here recording live together in my studio at the Bahnsen Group in Newport Beach, California, the CEO of Farmers and Merchants Bank, Henry Walker. The full disclosure I'll get out of the way is that I personally bank at Farmers and Merchants. I have now for, I think, 4 or 5 years after 25 adult years banking at Union Bank of California. I finally moved all my banking and have never, ever, ever been happier. All of our companies and related entities bank with Farmers as well. It's a very well-known banking chain here in the Southland of Southern California. So I'm going to let Henry tell us a little bit about his story, about the bank story, and we'll have a bit of a conversation. What's going on in this exciting world of banking, and there's some tough questions I want to be able to dive into. Henry Walker, welcome to the Capitol Record.
I appreciate it, David. And one correction for the record, I'm the president. My brother gets to be chairman and CEO. As a family bank now, fourth generation, 116 years. And so I have to
rotate it.
You have to give him that credit.
Give him his due, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting times, and it's time that it benefits to be a safe and well-capitalized bank. And, you know, that's the foundation of safeness. And I will tell you, as we've gone through these times here, as I grew up in banking, now 35-plus years, I started in banking with my brother, who's 12 years older than I, my father, and my grandfather at that lunch table.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go through banking 101 almost at every lunch. And those lessons that have been bestowed upon me, it's very interesting, as well as the history of my great-grandfather, who took over the National Bank of Long Beach in a bank run. And so that was back in 1907 that we had that history. And there are certain lessons that C.J. Walker, our founder, passed along that we still remind ourselves of every year at our annual banquet. And the first is safeguarding a client's money is a sacred trust.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never more apparent than that today. And the other interesting thing that CJ learned back in 1907, which was very true today, is he passed along this saying. He says one of his lessons from that day, because they brought the gold in, they stacked it on the counter, he told the clients, we'll be here, you know, Saturday, Sunday if we have to. But he says money comes before friendships. And only liquidity and a strong balance sheet can restore trust in a bank.
Yeah.
And that's the lesson that Silicon Valley, Signature, and to a large degree First Republic learned. They thought they had friends, and they did.
Yeah.
But money came first.
So do you think that the commitment to that quality of banking and safeguarding of customer assets is sufficient? We know it's necessary, but is it sufficient in a world of fractional reserve banking? Can sometimes there just be bad luck that takes down a good bank, or does it generally come down to poor decision making? It strikes me that when we look at IndyMac, Washington Mutual, it was very obvious you had very bad lending portfolio. Silicon Valley did not. They did not have impairments in who they lent money to. They had hot deposits. They were subject to a run. Two totally different categories of problem. But were they both management errors, or is there a sense in which systemically there's a risk of fractional reserve banking?
Well, as I reflect upon the issues in both those institutions, a good depositor base is stable and dependable, and that is part of a healthy balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Strong capital is the foundation always, right? And so you start with strong capital, which is certainly something we have, and a lot of other banks in our community do have, right? And then you look at the dependability and the stability of the deposit base. And I will tell you, that was their error. Both First Republic targeted the wealthy communities.
Mm-hmm.
Silicon as well had, i.e. hot money.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a story. When I was about 22 years of age, I was working alongside my father there at the main office in downtown Long Beach, and we had a little breakout room where we'd meet with customers. And from time to time, my dad would pull me into those rooms, and we'd meet with a customer and talk to him, and somebody would want to wow him. And that person would say, I'm going to bring you $50 million. And he'd look at him and say, no, thank you. And it shocked them because they never heard a banker turn down their $50 million.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd just say, no, thanks. And when I'd get out of the meeting, I'd look at my dad and I'd say, tell me about that. Tell me about that comment. He said, that person's not my customer.
Mm-hmm.
They're not here long term.
Yeah.
What can I do with the money other than put it in overnight funds?
Yeah.
At best, because I can't depend on it.
Yeah.
And you see that play out here. Enormously in some of what's going on. And I will tell you, one of the things that has not been talked about is the pressure that the Treasury has put on the deposits, particularly in the wealthy markets, right? Because the Treasury is going to offer 1.5%, 2% more than what the banks want to offer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got to fly the money to the Treasuries.
Yeah.
That's an issue that's not being talked about.
And is that the equivalent to money markets as well, which largely are consisting of T-bills that now are up to 400, 500 basis points?
Yeah.
Bank depositors can't receive that much if the banks are going to make any money at all.
That's right.
So there's a big incentive to pull money out.
There's flight to money markets,
yeah,
and there's flight to Treasury.
Yeah.
And your sophisticated wealthy clients,
yeah,
you know, they go, well, I'm going to move some money over here.
Yeah.
And that started in May of 22. And there hasn't been really any conversations about that in the marketplace either.
Well, I will say for those who read David Bonson's Dividend Cafe, I do a daily market recap, as many of the people that work for you know. And I've been talking about this almost daily. The idea that deposits started moving when Silicon Valley went down is fundamentally incorrect. It started moving, you say May of 22. And what is it that happened in May of 22? The Fed began intensely raising rates. And not just raising rates, but raising rates with a surprise to the market. They thought they're getting a quarter point at a time. The Fed spent about a year saying we're going to go a quarter at a time. And then they went three quarters at a time. And they did it four meetings in a row. And it could have been the right thing to do. It could have been the wrong thing to do. But the point was that really was the necessary response of the market. And so a lot of that liquidity has left the banking system, as you say. Is it correct, Banking 101, to say that there's two levers by which you can make money and that the net interest margin from deposits, in other words, you're receiving more than you're paying out in deposits, so some banks can compete by paying more in deposits to get funds, but they lose margin, or there's what you charge for lending, and you can charge less for mortgages you're giving, but then that takes away margin, but you could be more competitive, or you could charge more and have a higher margin, but maybe be less competitive. Those are the two knobs by which you compete in the market, what you're going to charge for lending and what you're going to pay out in deposits, and that finding that equilibrium is sort of the job of a banker.
Yeah, that's pretty much essentially, that's the trick, right? We're borrowers too.
Yeah.
All our depositors,
yeah,
that's whom we borrow from, right? Yeah. And what we have to pay, and then we invest money and we put it into loans or we put it into bonds.
Yeah.
And there's a difference there, and through that we pay our G&A and hopefully make a profit at the end of the day.
But you also have your own capital. And that capital has to underlie the financial stability of the bank. And it seems that SVB got in trouble not only from having hot deposits, but even their actual capital that was in the financial base of the bank had a duration mismatch, that there was a real significant problem with the value of a long-dated bond portfolio. Is that something that you think is systemic? How have you avoided some of those issues with the duration of your bonds?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, you select your bond portfolio carefully. You have maturities and you have durations, and you look for the shorter durations as you build your bond portfolio. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you still need adequate capital, you know? And we've grown up with having three times the required capital to be well capitalized at Farmers and Merchants. And that covers a lot of issues wherever they may be.
And you've grown up that way, meaning this isn't Basel III or Dodd-Frank for you.
This is from my grandfather and my great-grandfather.
Yeah.
It's always adequate capital. Mm-hmm. It's the foundation, because as much as we work hard and we're bright people, we anticipate a problem coming from, you know, a direction over here and then it comes from the side. It happens all the time in our lives. I've been doing this for 35 years. There's always something. And what covers you is adequate capital. Mm-hmm. And so I would tell you, when you build your balance sheet or that deposit base up to such a high level, you keep reducing your capital as a percentage of your overall balance mm-hmm. sheet. And then if you have an error in your investment strategy, which they did, you have to cover via your capital. You first take from earnings, and then you cover from capital. Yeah. And if they drown their earnings with unrealized losses and drown their capital, there's no way for them to recover, right? And so effectively, that's what happened. And then you have the other part of the asset base, which is loans. Nobody's talking about that either.
And it does seem, let's come back to the loan side, because I do think that needs to be talked about. But your Farmers right now is at $11 billion of deposit base?
We're 12.
$12
billion. Of assets and 10 of deposits.
So if you went to someone off the street and said, hey, Bank A has $180 billion of deposits and Bank B has $60 billion, don't you think most people would assume Bank A is a stronger bank than Bank B? Just the law of large numbers, it sounds like it's a more stable, sizable, impressive bank. The Bank A and Bank B in this case are both Silicon Valley. It's 2023 and 2020. Their own bank saw a tripling of the deposit base. It sounds like what you're pointing out is that in their tripling of deposit base, they became a weaker bank, a more fragile bank, as the capital base became a lower percentage of total assets.
So I'll go back to my commentary about my dad. He says, what am I going to do with that money? The best I could do is put it in overnight funds.
Yeah.
And if those depositors would have been happy with the returns that they could have given them on overnight funds, which probably had been about 10 basis points at that time, right? Mm-hmm. Then they would have kept the money. But there's a wisdom there that, you know, you have to watch your deposit base as a percentage of as to your capital. And you start with the capital, and what do you have to cover your deposit base? Because deposits come and go. Happens all the time. That's what we do. When we sign up to be bankers, what I commit to you, David, is that when you walk up to my window and ask for your money, I give it to you. That's the deal. That's the handshake. And, you know, hopefully we have a great relationship and I have a dependable, stable deposit base. Yep. But I, as a banker, have to keep your money safe. That's my responsibility. I guarantee I'll give it back, but I have to keep it safe. And that's the deal.
So in the sense that what happened is that there were too many people that wanted the money back, and what they had done with the bank was not go into unperforming mortgages. This is why I think it's so categorically different from 08, where there was a credit impairment. You had a significant amount of non-performing loans. The United States Treasury was performing on the loans that Silicon Valley had made to them, right? By buying Treasury bonds, they became a creditor of the United States government. But they, I think, ended up taking a 10 or 11% haircut to liquidate. Cost a few billion dollars of capital, a few billion they didn't have, while $42 billion famously came out of the deposit base in one day. Do you blame the Fed for incentivizing banks to reach out the yield curve by keeping rates at 0% for so long? Is that monetary policy a problem here?
Well, let's remember in January 22, effectively they forecasted their rate raises for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And they said 1.5%.
Yes, they did.
And when they say 1.5% for the year, bankers take that and put it into budget. Yep. Now, if you went 2 or 2.5, that's not too much of a deviation, but when you go over 4, it's the fastest rate rise we've ever had in our history.
But it's also fair to point out that not only did they say 1.5, and you're saying if they went 50 basis points over, that's one thing, but 21 out of 21 years, if they were wrong, it was because it was less than they projected, not more than they projected.
Right.
So if anything, you're erring the other direction, I would think.
When they started that climb, right? The Treasury started to climb as well.
Mm-hmm.
And followed pari passu. So then you have several different issues that are in the marketplace. The bonds they bought were quality bonds, AAA, no credit risk in the bonds. Their loan portfolio, can't speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
If it was long-term mortgages, you know, at very low rates, that's a problem, right? When banks then go long on the lending side and don't have a reset in price.
And is that a problem because mark to market, they're now underwater, or is it a problem because—
It's interest rate risk.
Interest rate risk, yeah.
And so you're managing not only a quality portfolio, you're also managing interest rate risk.
Yeah.
And that's one of those jobs. And that interest rate risk comes back to your earlier comments about net interest margin,
yeah,
as well, right? And so everything kind of plays together relative to managing how you invest that money,
yeah,
right? And the banks as a whole started to pull back, you know, their fixed rate lending and what they portfolio. But there are some banks out there that have gone long in the mortgage side at very low rates. You know, they could perhaps borrow against them, but if they had to sell them, right, there'd be a discount on them.
Yeah.
Like anything with a rate below market, I don't care if it's a bond, it's a mortgage. I don't care if it's an apartment building you bought at a 3.5 cap and now they're 5 caps.
Yeah.
There's going to be a discount somewhere in there, right?
Are you comfortable speaking to First Republic a little bit? It's almost easier to talk about Silicon Valley because they're already effectively gone. First Republic is still an ongoing competitor and presence in the banking world. And so I don't want to overstep with anything. It does seem that what you're bringing up there is a much bigger issue for them than even Silicon Valley, because even if they wanted to go do a transaction right now, raise equity in the marketplace, find a strategic acquirer, their loans are so below market in terms of that yield that they would effectively force a markdown that I think would be untenable.
I would have to, you know, I don't have the insight to their loan portfolio as a whole and what the duration is on it or what the reset is on it.
Yeah.
Or have they set them out, securitized them, and bought them back. Yeah. I don't have that insight. Yeah.
But a business strategy, lending at below market rates to attract ultra high net worth deposits, you would view as a somewhat vulnerable strategy.
Yeah, you can't have. That's not necessarily your best market, right? Yeah. I joke with some of my friends here in Newport Beach, and I say your wealthiest client is not necessarily your best client.
Yeah,
they're good. We like them. But I like the people in Long Beach. I like the people elsewhere in Orange County and Downey and Lakewood and these working communities, right? Because mm-hmm. it's dependable, stable, sticky deposits.
Yeah.
And that's what you build a bank on. And you know, it's a different strategy versus just chasing the wealth all the way up the coast.
Is the percentage of uninsured deposits a metric that was well known and spoken of in the banking world before SVB? I never evaluated it that way. And then the data became anecdotally interesting to see that I think it was something like 90% of SVB's deposits were above the FDIC insurance threshold. It's not a surprise that JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, they have a much lower percentage because they have so many depositors under 250,000. Is that a metric that is generally indicative of safety?
Oh, I think that good bankers know their deposit base and where there's concentrations and how they're managing it and the loyalty of those deposits.
And you know it by relationship with your customers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, they talk about regional banks. I will tell you, the regional banks know exactly what's on their balance sheet. The larger you get, the less you know actually what your investments are. I mean, I can go through our balance sheet. I know exactly the loans we have. I know what bonds we have. We look at everything on a weekly basis. You know, we know, right, what is in our balance sheets and whether we're secure or where there's an issue.
Yeah.
That's what we have.
So, but is that part and parcel the same thing? A bank like yours is in a position to know your balance sheet, to know your assets, and also to know your customers. And a larger bank is much less likely to be able to do either of those two things.
They're less likely to know exactly all that they invested in. And, you know, that moves between the $200 billion to the trillion-dollar banks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's not that many of them, candidly. I think Silicon, First Republic are in the top 40, right? And Farmers and Merchants is in the top 100, approximately, right? And but we know, and banks like us know exactly how we've invested our money and what's in our portfolio because we're very hands-on. We touch every aspect and the customers, right?
You're privately owned, family owned. What, CW 1907, is that your great-grandfather?
CJ is 1907, yeah, my great-grandfather.
And so the bank has been in your family, and you've been at the bank 35 years, your brother and yourself both in leadership now. Do you believe, Henry, apart from your own business model and us, you know, talking your book, but as a kind of best practices idea, do you think banks are better owned privately than in public markets? Do you have a strong opinion on that one way or the other?
You know, we are closely held versus completely private.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that model, David, because there is continued level of accountability. I mean, we are heavily regulated for sure. And I don't see this as a regulator failure by any means. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, the regulators work hard, but we are still private businesses. We are not a government institution. Mm-hmm. And people also forget that, you know, and we need the marketplace to think about, I need to bank with a safe bank versus just somebody who's going to pay me 5-6% on a CD. Yeah. And mind you, there's banks out there now paying 5-6% on CDs. Yeah. And what I tell my staff is, you better ask why, mm-hmm. right? We need a marketplace that looks and considers where they're putting their money and to value safety. Because when they do it, it makes a healthier economy for all banks.
Yeah.
Right?
The whole system is
stronger. The whole system is stronger if they seek safe places to put their money. And then when they do that, I can compete and I'll beat them on competition.
Yeah.
I'll beat them on service every day. Yeah. Day in, day out.
That's right.
And, that's what we look for. And that's kind of the hallmark of regional banks.
Did Dodd-Frank hurt your bank? Did it hurt the banking business model that is more service-oriented, relationship-oriented? Do you think that some of the post-financial crisis developments have served to codify the too-big-to-fail?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do think they codified the too-big-to-fail. And it was supposed to break them up.
That's right.
Right? And it has not done that.
Yeah, I think
they don't even talk about it anymore.
Silicon Valley, I think, was the 16th largest by deposit. Signature was something in the 20s. First Republic is between 10 and 15. You have these banks with their challenges over the last 2 months, and then just monumental amounts of deposits flowing into the Big Four. It seems to me counterintuitive to what they talked about with Dodd-Frank. They helped build it up.
Yeah. And the media created an undue scare, right? I mean, had the media not created an undue scare, there may not have been any issues.
But isn't that the nature of fractional reserve banking, going all the way back to George Bailey, that there is a self-fulfilling prophecy to this, right? That, if the scare is there, it becomes a problem.
That's right.
When you say media, there's an interesting dynamic here, though. It wasn't NBC News, right? It was social media. You have VC guys tweeting out, pull your funds and so forth. And we won't get into the specifics of who was doing what and why, but you're right. It does seem that this went real quickly. Myself, being a farmer's customer and being familiar with your technological apparatus, I wonder if you have concerns about people's ability with their apps and their technology to move money so quickly. Does that add to vulnerability in the system, or not? If the bank is being well run, you don't have to worry about it.
You have to run a good bank, mm-hmm. and if they couldn't move the money via an app, they would have walked into the lobby and demanded a cashier's check.
Yeah,
or they would have wired right. They would have walked in the lobby. Yeah. You know, one way or another. If somebody's panicking, they're going to get their money, right?
Yeah.
And certainly we were the beneficiary of some of those calls at Farmers and Merchants. You know, when Silicon went down on Friday, I was getting calls. How do we move our money to your bank? And, that went on through the weekend.
And do you credit that? Because it's sort of counterintuitive to the media narrative that said people wanted to pull out of all smaller banks to go to big banks. You were getting calls to move from some of these other mid-size to come into your bank, and it wasn't because you were so big like J.P. Morgan. They didn't confuse Henry Walker with Jamie Dimon. It was because of the reputation of your service, your quality, your history, relationship banking. I guess I'm putting you in a position of having to compliment yourselves, and I don't mean to do that, but pragmatically, is that what customers were thinking? We trust this entity.
We have done the right thing for many, many years, and our marketplace knows it, and they know how we run, and they know how we lend, and that we're a very conservative lender.
Yeah, does that ever hurt you?
You know, in the go-go times, it always hurts you to be conservative, right?
Yeah,
because people go elsewhere, and then safety comes up. Came up in 2000. It came up in 2008. It comes up again today. It's a reoccurring theme. And then people will think about it for a couple years, 3 years, then they'll forget. and they'll go back to where the free money is. But we have to stick the course.
But that's a cyclicality that is rooted in human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you got to bank around human nature.
And so, those things happen most certainly in banking. But, we did have people calling and sending money in. The amount of accounts we've opened in just the first quarter, and that's been a flight from the big banks, big four, and now for safety.
So I will let you go with this. We hear all the time that the world of small banking, community banking, relationship banking, that it's going to be obsolete, that they're trying to force everyone into four or five big banks. My experience with farmers, I talk to people, and I got to think there's other farmers out there in the country besides yours and your closely held bank. I don't doubt that there's a lot of really well-run banks in the country. But you know what's funny? We're sitting here in my office in Newport Beach. The branch at which I bank is right down the street on Pacific Coast Highway, Corona del Mar. I've never been in the branch, ever. They have people that will come to the office. We have heavy communication. They know my name. They know my kid's name. It's just people wouldn't believe it when I tell them that the relationship component. And I do not bring it up just simply to talk about farmers, but other banks around the country. I guess I want to leave our audience with some optimism that they don't have to pick between woke mega banks and vulnerable, risky banks that could be the next Silicon Valley, that there is still a business model that works profitably and sustainably for small relationship-minded banks. Do you feel optimistic about the business model of relationship banking?
I do. You know, there's 4,700 banks in the country. We are the most heavily regulated entity in the country over healthcare. And we are well-run. A group of institutions, and people do have good choices in their banking out there. They do not have to suffer with bad service, and there's just a lot of options. And part of the reason our U.S. economy is the world leader is because of a good banking system, mm-hmm. where there's diversity, where there's bankers out there who can meet with small business owners and work with them both in lending and deposit and guidance. Many times we become counselors for business owners. That's what banking's about. We are part of the community and proud to be part of the community.
Yeah. Henry, I happen to be a man of faith. I talk about this website being to promote the vision of a free and virtuous society. And my belief is free enterprise has no chance of being sustained if we divorce it from virtue. And virtue doesn't have any chance of being virtuous if it is divorced from freedom. So I want both those things juxtaposed as we defend a market economy. I know there's a bit of faith in your family. Do you view the character traits of the bank, the value system that you talk about here today, as related at all to faith?
100%. That faith started with my great grandmother and my great grandfather, and has been passed down to us today. We talk in our mission statement about Christian values, and I will tell you, they impact the way we run our bank. They impact the tenure we have in our staffing. And we firmly believe that all that we have has not come by our own hand, but has been lent to us by our Lord, and it is for us to manage.
Well, I can't thank you enough for sharing a bit of your story here, of the Farmers and Merchants banking story, sharing your wisdom in these interesting times. Hopefully those that are out there right now worried about the state of banking can get a little optimism out of the message today. I really appreciate you spending a little time with us here. I hope you'll come back to Capital Record.
Well, thank you very much, David. Glad to be here.
And thank you all for listening to another episode of National Review's Capital Record. I do stand by what I said, that the vision of a free and virtuous society does require us to hold tight to both freedom and to virtue, not sacrificing one for the sake of the other. I have my shareholder meeting coming up at JP Morgan on May 16th, where my resolution is on the docket, encouraging them to ensure that they are not discriminating against banking customers on the basis of their political or religious views. As we look at increasing degrees of wokeness and sometimes what seems like insanity from various elements of Fortune 100 corporate America, I do want to remind people that there are private businesses, family businesses, closely held businesses that are the backbone of the American economy that have not waved the white flag to the present culture war. Farmers and Merchants Bank is now several generations of high-quality banking. I've been a really pleased customer for some time. There's many other Farmers and Merchants out there. There are car wash companies. There are other wealth management firms like the Bonson Group. Plenty of companies that still believe in free enterprise and a value system that you don't need to be discouraged by. So keep fighting the good fight and hold fast to the idea that if we defend free enterprise and capital markets, that we will necessarily advance the cause of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to Capital Record.